Every mountain top is within reach if you just keep climbing by Barry Finlay. Hello and welcome all listeners. I'm your host Sumang Panchal, inviting you to this phenomenal episode number 5 of Expedel Podcast. Today we have a very special guest joining us from Colorado, and his name itself is enough to feel the adventure, thrill and sensation of the excitement about world's most dangerous expeditions. He featured in many renowned news, magazines and articles such as National Geographic, Discovery and Animal Planet. He is the first man from United States of America who got the prestigious achievement of Adventure Grand Slam. And as per data, we know that there are only 12 people on the world who have finished the adventurous, dangerous and most desperate expeditions. He summited Mount Everest 5 times and have done all 7 summits located in the different continents of the world. And now, his polar expedition to the North Pole and the South Poles were the world's most noticeable expeditions because it was unsupported and unassisted. And I also can say that he also has Master Polar Guide certification from IPGA and has a Wilderness First Responder certification. So it will take a whole day if I am going to describe his achievements and expeditions. Without getting more time, I feel thrilled and zestful to have Ryan Waters, the most noticeable and the most amazing mountaineer, founder and director of Mountain Professional, a company dedicated to its client to provide world-class services in their adventure exploration. Welcome, Ryan, to my show at Expedel Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. Nice to see you on this fine Friday.
Nice to see you too, Ryan. It will be so awesome for the next talk, and I feel vibrant and enthusiastic to have you over here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So Ryan, I always ask this question to all my guests, that how did they find their passion? What was the igniting event, the incident, or I can say the story that happened in their life that they fall into love with some specific will what they are doing right now? And hence, I want to ask you that how did you find your love for the mountaineering, for the adventurous expedition, and how did you start your professional expeditions at the different location? And what were the places have you explored during your early career in the mountaineering?
Yeah, I think it's similar to a lot of people where I grew up just really enjoying the outdoors and like backpacking when I was growing up and things. And as I got into I was about 18 when I discovered rock climbing. And that was the thing that really kind of launched me into really getting out and kind of more stuff, not just backpacking. And I got really into it through my college years and then after university. And so I was actually working as a geologist for a few years after school and taking trips with friends to go climb stuff and go rock climbing all the time. But I was similar to a lot of people. I was reading books about traveling and expeditions around the world. And I was just enthralled by all these, you know, amazing stories from Mount Everest and the Himalayas and all this stuff. And so as a few years went on, I was bitten by the bug to want to travel and just like go climbing and go adventure. So I'd already been a rock climber, but so I wanted to learn how to climb big mountains, like mountaineering, you know, where you have to walk with crampons and ice axes and things. And so I took a course out in California and climbed my first kind of big mountain, I guess you would say, Mount Shasta in California. And I loved it. I loved that process of kind of, you know, climbing the big peaks on glaciers. And so I was really hooked on that side of climbing as well. And from there, it just like, I couldn't keep that desire down anymore. And though I loved working as a geologist, and I did be able to work outside and kind of a mix of office work and outdoor work, but I just had this thing pulling me somewhere else. And I decided one day to do, I had what I call my mid-20s crisis. And I just gave up on my career, like a stable career. And I just took a job as a instructor doing rock climbing instruction. And from there, it just like, I never stopped. I was learning how to be an instructor and eventually a mountain guide, and started traveling to South America a lot to climb mountains and work down in the Patagonia region. And so it was just like, it was the best decision I made ever, just to kind of follow that passion and see where it took me. I didn't know what I was going, where I was going, and if I could make money or do anything. But I just decided that it was worth it. I could feel it enough inside that I knew it was the right choice to just kind of pursue this passion for climbing and taking adventures and travel and everything else. And so, I've been on that path for probably 18 years now after that decision. And so it's been amazing to travel the world and get to do all these expeditions.
I think it's phenomenal that you just followed your instinct, the thing what you want to do in your life, the thing what make more alive for you. And that's why you followed your instinct. And that's why you are at the stage where nobody else right now. I feel so.
Well, there's plenty of people out there that have done a lot of great things and harder things and different things. And, you know, you just do it, follow the passion, like you say, and see where it takes you. And for me, I've been lucky to get very good connections with people throughout the years that, you know, I just happened to run into and stayed in touch with and got opportunities to go do some trips that, you know, maybe I would not have had that thought or something, but I said yes. And that, you know, the key I found is saying yes and like taking chances and like kind of going and doing some trips, even if it's a little out of your comfort zone. And sometimes that leads you to new things that are basically what happened to me. I mean, you know, I just kept climbing and climbing, and then eventually got into polar skiing through, my friends and my contacts. And then, so same thing, you know, follow your passion, and sometimes it works out as long as you stick with it and really pursue that passion.
I totally agree with you. And that's why I have found the quote that don't just follow your passion, let your passion find you.
Yeah.
And this is really important for me as well. And we all know that you have submitted all that 7 different summits from all around the world. And during that all exploration, I think, which was your toughest journey, you believe that? Does it was like a mountain, or do you believe anything else was there?
I think for me, the hardest expedition I've ever been on was skiing to the North Pole from the coast of Canada to the pole, which, you know, is called a coastal trip, or it used to be called a full length trip, but we're in the polar community trying to get away from that phrasing, just to clarify things. But that's the hardest trip I think I've been on. But for climbing, you know, the 7 summits they're challenging and hard, but there is quite a buildup of experience, and you can kind of, you know, a lot of people are doing those mountains, and that's my main job, is guiding people from all over the world on these 7 summits. And so I get to see that lots of people can do that as they put in the time and learn skills and stuff. So they're all hard, but, you know, for me, I would think some of the other expeditions I've been on in like Pakistan and some other climbs were maybe harder than the 7 summits that I've been on. It's I've been around quite a bit, at least in the Himalayas, you know, mm-hmm. I think last time I counted up, I've been on like 24 Himalayan trips. And so that's a lot of different mountains in Tibet, Pakistan, yeah. Nepal. And so you run into a lot of hard things and a lot of challenges, and I, you know, not summiting all those mountains and turning around and seeing some rescues and accidents and things like that. So it's been quite a ride along that journey.
I believe so. I believe that the journey, especially for the mountain or for the any kind of mountain climbing, is dangerous when the weather is bad. And I also, if you are saying about something, the different weather and all the situation, I know about the K2 mountain, which is known as the world's second most largest, the highest, or I can say the tallest mountain. And I heard a lot of story about that it's the most dangerous among all. So can you please explain something about that?
Yeah, you know, and one thing to keep, that's a very common explanation for K2. I would say that label of the most dangerous or the hardest, what a lot of, it's you know, if you're just out reading the, say, mainstream news sites and things, or even some climbing sites, you may get that impression, but you know, if you take different kinds of statistics and things, then some people would say other mountains are the hardest or most dangerous. Like, I think Kanchenjunga in Nepal has the worst, like, death to summit ratio or whatever, like even more than K2 or so. But yes, to the point, K2 is definitely a very difficult, dangerous mountain. It's very challenging, you know, harder for sure than climbing Everest in the traditional fashion, where people are going on the normal routes and fixed ropes and things like that. Because everything is relative, right? Like, there's much harder routes to climb on smaller peaks than, say, climbing Mount Everest via the normal route that is fixed with rope every year and things like that. So, but yeah, K2 is definitely challenging. It has some hard weather comparatively to Nepal, the Everest area. And it's just steeper, you know, the route is steep the whole way. And so it's challenging, and there's some issues with avalanches on the main routes and rockfall and everything else. So you definitely have to have all your senses firing when you go to K2 for sure. It's challenging.
Got you. I understand that. And the another thing I have always keep in mind when I was doing my camping outside, it's all about the weather. It's all about the climate, how it should be. When you are there point, it should be great. It should be good, at least as per the prediction. So how you decide about the dates and the time for the trips, especially for the mount climbing, the Everest climbing? And do you really rely on the Nepal government, or do you have your own forecast team for the weather condition over there?
Yeah, all the mountains, some you can climb all year if they're lower in different parts of the world, but specifically there in Everest, it's the best season is in the springtime, so April, May, and that's largely driven by the monsoon that comes up from Bay of Bengal each season.
Yep.
And so you have the monsoon weather in the summertime. So you tend to get like the best stable weather in the springtime. And also there's a kind of a opposite time period in the autumn, September, October. It's also good, but it's a little bit, tends to get a little more snow and you're going into the winter as you're there. So it's getting colder on the mountain. As opposed to summertime, you get to the mountain early to start doing your climbs up and down and acclimatizing and getting ready. And so as you're there, it's, you know, getting warmer every day because you're approaching summertime. So that's the reason you see all the summits mostly in May, because people have spent April in the early part of May, getting ready as a group or a team and doing their rotations on the mountain, and then getting ready for that kind of mid-May to late May summit window that happens because of that, the pressure coming from the monsoon and raising the winds above the summit on certain days, because it has a tendency to push the jet stream that's always on the upper mountain a little higher off the top. And so those are the windows that we're all looking for, is when that wind's going to lift up high and get off the top of the mountain, and have like stable weather. And, you know, most expeditions are using outside weather forecasts that we pay for. And specifically my company, we have a professional weather forecaster that, that does that expedition for us. So he's sending us via email of like graphs and forecasts for upcoming days, so that we look at it and start thinking, you know, about when the best weather window is going to happen, and then plan accordingly to try to get in position for the summit.
I understand. So for your company, you have a special team that can guide you for the better weather and the situation with it.
Yeah. It's a, you know, more and more the weather system, or let's say meteorologists worldwide, they've been pooling information on certain, you know, forecasting sites. And in reality, you could use the local Nepali. The Nepali government has a pretty good forecast, and that's mostly our Sherpas that work with us. They're always looking at that forecast. And so I take what they say is, you know, on that, and then compare it against the one we're paying for. And then maybe take one or two other online resources while we're at base camp. And I kind of compare all of them and see if it's looking like they're true or not. And then kind of going from there.
Okay. I just got that information that there are a couple of other things you rely on that. And by collecting all the information from the different sources, you will get all the background for the weather, and then you can make your decision when to go and when to start the expedition. Nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I believe that Mount Everest is such an amazing thing, but I feel that it's the story of life and the death and the strength of the human spirit. And I can say, yeah, it's the world's legendary mountain, but it's simultaneously, it's also the notorious mountain, I believe. And the reality of the Everest is really, really impossible to comprehend. But the thing, what happened when I was watching a story of Shreya Shah, she's a Canadian girl. She was a Canadian girl who tried to attempt to climb the Everest. And as per the documentary, her body is still there in Canadian flag. And I have seen the picture and I was speechless. It blew my mind that still the body is there on the Everest. And also the movie, the Everest, as per that, the main character, Rob, the body of him is also there. And I was like, whoa. Means it's the most dangerous. It's not easy task, and that's why you already submitted the Everest 5 times, and I know that each time you did, you may have faced like some uncertain situation and the bad weather conditions, and that's why. Have you ever felt that these conditions, sometime these conditions are beyond your limits, and it could be the last moment of your life. So have you ever felt that kind of things over there?
Yeah. I've felt it before personally, but more on, I would say more tied to like avalanches, like being at the wrong place at the wrong time and having something coming down, and you're kind of worried that could be the end. But you know, Everest, it's so, basically what happens is, when you're just like anything else in life, if you do stuff more and more, it tends to get a little easier, right? So if you're climbing big mountains, and like Everest, it's always hard for sure. And it's always, you know, tiring and tough mornings and cold and all the stuff. But as you do it, you know, 5-10 times, like some people, it's, you know, where everything is coming, you know, where the next rest spot is, you know, where, you know, all the stuff to expect. And so it becomes a little easier mentally as you do it. Then you're just at the whim of all the environmental stuff. Like, is the weather good, or is it going to suddenly a storm comes? Or, you know, in my personal kind of world, it's like, how are the clients? Cause I'm always guiding people. So that's your main focus, really. You as a guide, you're really not even thinking of yourself while you're climbing anymore. You're just like, well, it's a great morning, but how are my people doing? You're only thinking of what, are they clipping on the ropes correctly? Are they feeling good? Are they having a problem with altitude? All this stuff is running through your head and you don't really think of yourself that much anymore. But I have had experiences with altitude personally, you know, gotten sick with acute mountain sickness on mountains. And so I know that what it's like. And so those are times when you really feel bad and you hate the place you're in and you're like, wow, I wish I wasn't on this mountain. But even that, those kind of situations, you tend to get better at, like you can personally maybe anticipate a little better, like, ooh, I'm not feeling so good. And I know this is a sign of maybe the onset of an altitude problem. So I need to do something to fix that. Like maybe I need to stop and ask my other people to go ahead and I'll go down and rest or drink more water or take, you know, some oxygen or something. So you start to be able to, you know, knock down these problems before they get bigger. But to answer your question on the large scale, there are people up on that, on Everest and other mountains that unfortunately didn't make it down. And you do see some of them sometimes, and it depends on if, you know, they're in a place where it's just too hard for anyone or, you know, a group of people to help get that person down afterwards, that they're just still there. And you know, even like Rob Hall or Scott Fisher, these guys, not Rob, but Scott Fisher, like pretty much everyone knows where he is. And if you want to go see him, you know, fortunately you can take a little veer off this one spot where we all know where he is. He's not like, you know, just right there sitting on the route, but it's one of those things that unfortunately you get a little desensitized to seeing people if you're there a lot and you see dead people. It's a terrible feeling no matter what, but it's something you just get kind of used to in a way. And so for me personally, I always shield that stuff from my clients, you know, like I don't have to focus on the person laying there. I can just be like, hey guys, right up here, we're going to have to go around, you know, this person, don't look down, just think, you know, and in a lot, for a lot of people, that's very weird, strange to hear. And they would even say like, that's very selfish of you to just be still climbing for yourself while there's a person nearby. And I understand that, you know, people would say that, but it's also important to remember that those people were doing the same thing we're doing, you know, they were trying to climb and something happened and it's unfortunate, but, you know, people still will climb the mountains because they get something else out of it. They love it and they want to do it for their own reasons. So we still go.
I got you. I understand that what you have said, and you said one important thing that you want, that you don't stand over there at the wrong place at the wrong time. And if you are there, it can be the critical moment to survive at Everest. And that's what the thing happened with me when I was reading a book of Everest. I got these names called as Dead Zone. the Hilleri step. And one of these is like a east-south reach. And I feel that these are the points, these are the places which are like a wrong places, but I have to clear that points in order to submit the Everest. So what do you think, why it's named as a death zone and why it's so difficult and what do you think about it?
Well, the death zone is kind of described as the altitude above 8,000 meters. Okay. So that's why you hear it associated with Everest a lot, because it's one of the 14 8,000 meter peaks and the most famous one that everyone talks about. And so you'll often hear, you know, the death zone on Everest, but in reality, there's, you know, 14 mountains where you have to be in the death zone if you're going to try to climb them, because they're over 8,000 meters in altitude. And that's what that refers to. And it's just kind of like a biological altitude that has to do with the barometric pressure that and the effects it has on your body and with regards to processing oxygen in your body and everything. And so it's kind of just this ceiling or that a lot of doctors say once you're over that, realistically, your body shouldn't be able to survive for long, long times, because it's just too different of an environment for the human body to live in that kind of barometric pressure and the less oxygen per square foot in the air to breathe. So that's why this death zone is thought to be like, the whole idea is you want to get up and back down out of it really efficiently. And on Everest, at least on the Nepal side, the high camp that you leave to go to the summit is right at 8,000 meters. And so when you get to your camp four, the high camp, you're basically like sleeping in that death zone for part of a night, leaving to climb to the summit, and coming back down and sleeping usually one more night at 8,000 meters, and then descending right away, because you just don't want to spend more time than you need to above there. And you also get weaker just spending time at that altitude. Your body's just kind of running down slowly as you're spending. So it's just that kind of ceiling, right? You get over 8,000 meters and things happen. So you don't want to spend a lot of time above that altitude. You want to get up to a summit and try to get back down below.
I understand. So as per the medical term, your body have to do much more than anything. And that's why it's called as the death zone. If you are living there a lot of time, then it may be hazardous for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And also one more important thing is like the Hilleri step and the Southeast race. I have seen that it's like a very, very narrow place on the mountain to pass. And there are a lot of incidents happened in the past. So what do you think about it? How you followed the path, or what are your techniques to just pass that critical thing?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of, I mean, I've been climbing the first time I climbed that, the Nepal side. I climbed the Tibetan side first back in 2004, but then I climbed the Nepal side on 2008 for the first time. And I can see the dramatic difference in how difficult the Hilleri step used to be back in 2008. And it's changed quite considerably till now. Like I wasn't there this year because of the pandemic, but last year, the Hilleri step was actually quite easy compared to what it used to be. And a lot of people think that part of that may be due to the massive earthquake that happened in Nepal in 2015, because there's kind of this one blocky section right there next to the Hilleri step that kind of is not showing up in pictures as much. So it's kind of like this debate of, did it change? But, you know, it's just on the narrow ridge, very close to the summit. It gets very narrow at the bottom of the Hilleri step, and you have like a very big drop off to your right, like thousands of feet, pretty much straight down if you look over the edge. Okay. And then to your left, it's a little less steep, but still many thousand feet to your left. And so you're on this very narrow little walkway on the snow. And then the Hillary step is, it just suddenly gets steep for about 10 meters. And it used to be like rock that we would have to climb, you know, rocky, icy. And thankfully there was fixed ropes there. So it made it easier and more safe. But nowadays it's more snow. It's still steep snow, but much easier than it used to be. And definitely more secure feeling, because I never had a problem climbing up the Hillary step. It's more scary actually rappelling back down it, because you're looking down and you see the massive drop-offs. So when you're rappelling and just relying on that rope, and you get the feeling of big exposure there. And so you're really, you know, just hoping that that rope holds like it should while you're rappelling down.
I understand that. Yeah, now I can feel the difficulty while you are returning back. It's important to take care of yourself. You have the joy and the excitement to summit the mountain, but you need to take care of, you have to reach to the bottom as well.
Yeah.
So, Ryan, I have heard this beautiful sentence that it's an altitude. It's not an altitude. It's an attitude in order to summit the Everest. And Everest challenges the human spirit, the capabilities, and I can see the willpower and perseverance also. And I believe that it is the world's most throbbing attraction in every mind to summit an Everest once in his life. But what are the skills or the physical abilities, or I can say the mindset, you believe that the person should have to acquire in order to summit the Everest?
I think that saying holds a lot truer than people can realize for a mountain like Mount Everest, because as long as you have a certain amount of hard skills that you have to have to go up, you know, with regards to crampons and ropes and stuff like that, to be guided by people. After that, it really becomes, you know, it's mental. Yeah. It's like understanding that you're going to face challenges. You're going to face mornings and days where you are not having fun. You're really hot, you're too cold, or it's too hard, or it's too high, and there's no air and all that stuff. But if you have it in your mind that you are going to put one foot in front of the other and take care of yourself, eating and drinking and looking out for your people you're climbing with, and you just keep going, you can keep climbing and keep climbing and make it to the summit, as long as you have the willpower that you set out from the very bottom with that. And it's a marathon of a climb. It's because it's so long, you know, a month and a half usually of time that you're spending there, that you have to just take it as a big marathon and don't even think of the summit when you first get to the mountain. You're just trying to go to camp one first. And if you can do the camp one climb and come back down and feel good and take rest and take care of yourself, then you start thinking, then I can go to camp two. So you try to mentally just do these little hurdles and remain positive. And then if you're feeling good, then when you do go on that summit push, you know, then it's all up here, and it's going to be difficult and scary, and you'll have anxiety the night before you're leaving for the summit. But having that positive mental attitude is huge. You know, many people I've been to the summit with have gotten very close and looked at me or one of my other guides working and said, you know, I don't think I can do it.
And
it's up to us, if you're with people, to recognize if that's really the case, like maybe they really shouldn't be going further.
Okay.
Because, you know, they're too tired, or it's going to be dangerous going back down. Or is it just that they're overwhelmed, you know, tired and And maybe it is just mentally challenging that last bit, and it's your job to say, you know, you can do it. Come on, let's climb this together. Let's finish it. We only have, 30 minutes left, and try to help push each other past that mental block. And then people are really excited, you know, if they can overcome that little hurdle at the end, just to mm-hmm. kind of get themselves to the top. And it's quite amazing to see that when people, they have it in their mind that I'm gonna get to the summit. And then when they finally do accomplish that goal, it's like a sometimes years worth of work and mental preparation and you know, trying to raise the money that it costs and training and all that stuff. So once you get back down, it's just like a relief for people. And, you know, it's a very joyous time to celebrate the summit of Everest with each other.
I understand that. So you have said it's a month and a half. So the whole journey to climb the Everest and to come back, it's like a month and a half.
Yeah. You know, because you have to acclimatize. So you need to go up to Camp One and come back down and take some rest and go again up and do, and you know, and you have to trek into the base camp, which takes 10 days, and you have to spend some time in Kathmandu before. So it's a, you know, in out of a long, like I would say roughly 40 days, 45 days of stuff that you have to do. You may only be really climbing, you know, 7 or 8 of those days on the actual mountain. The rest of it is like trekking the base camp and rest days at base camp and, you know, doing all this other stuff that it takes to get up to the summit. So it just takes time. And then, so it adds up basically.
Wow. So I think there are 4 camps are there. Camp 1, Camp 2, until Camp 4. And then you, after Camp 4, there is the summit.
Okay,
I got you. And I would like to say for you, Ryan, that your company, Mountain Professional, have such a tremendous reputation, and the customer satisfaction by the services and the supports that you provided. And I also have seen the team on your website, and I have searched that they have vast amount of experience and knowledge, and this is really helpful for your customers to having such a tremendous work team, such a tremendous team over there with their expenditures. And but the thing is, many of us, like, we don't know that from where, from which point we can start the journey to Everest, to summit the Everest. And that's why how you handle your customers having no such experience of mountaineering, and they just call, hey Ryan, I just want to go for to summit the mountain and Mount Everest, and let me know how can we do it. So how you do with that?
You believe it or not, that happens a lot. with emails, it's kind of a not an easy answer to the question, in that some people may be ready to attempt to climb Everest with a guide much earlier than someone else, just because of like their preparation, their strength, their skills, their experience. And the only way you really know that, or the best way you know it, is if you do some trips with people before. Right, because then you're like, oh, we went to a mountain in Argentina and climbed that, and it's high and all this stuff, and so you can work with the person and start to know their strengths and weaknesses and explain, you know, maybe this other one is the next step you should do before ever, and you can kind of coach them on getting ready for a real and safe attempt. Because for me, as an owner of a company, I don't want to just take people to the to Everest, and they don't have a real chance of summiting. You know, I want them to be prepared so that they're really like, we're thinking like, yeah, they're probably going to summit. You know, that's our thought, because less, you know, something goes wrong that we can't foresee. So, partly answering your question is if someone asks us out of that we don't know, say on an email, and they are like asking, I want to climb Everest. Okay. You know, first thing we'll say is, great, you know, I always try to be like positive, and that's awesome. Great dream to have. What's your experience so far? That's the first question. And more often than not, if that person doesn't have any experience, you just never hear from them again, because you're already putting up a roadblock in their mind, like, oh, I don't want to put in some time or effort to get ready. I just want to go do it.
Yeah.
And I see that more and more in our society these days, where people want things very fast and kind of quick fixes with social media and everything else. Yeah. You know, like, I just want to be able to climb Everest and say I took a picture and that kind of thing. Whereas in the years gone by, it was a little more common for people to really invest the time climbing mountains for years and thinking of Everest off in the future. Yeah. And it's just a little less like that now. People kind of more want to do it on their third mountain or whatever.
Mm.
And so it just, for us, it's our part of our job is to talk with them, say, we would suggest doing this kind of mountain first, getting this training, go with this on a different mountain, and we'll talk about that progression to go to Everest. That's how we do it.
Okay, that's really good, because you just tell them, this can be happen with you if you go without the training, without the experience. And then you also guide them. You can say the things that the other trips they can do to get experience, the skills, and then they are ready for Everest.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And Ryan, what the other thing I believe is that what happened many times, unpredicted these conditions, and there's altitude, and that's why what happened, the attitude, the determination, and the love for the family can help one to do more than any motivation ever. And that's why I have this question specially for you, that how does your family help you, or I can say to motivate you to make this possible and go to this like dangerous expeditions?
I would say my immediate family for years first thought I was crazy to just go do all this stuff. but we're always supportive of just following along. And over the years, I mean, I've been doing it long enough to where it's pretty normal for them now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I've been really fortunate to have family that's very supportive of that dream and that path I went on. And so it's been really nice to be able to. And you have people to lean on and call if you're having hard times on expeditions. And, you know, if they support what you're doing and understand that you really can't live without this stuff, that makes a big difference, because I'm sure a lot of people's families are less supportive and they think that maybe you're climbing for silly reasons that are dangerous and, you know, maybe selfish or something. But if people just understand that it's something you really have a true passion for and you kind of, it's part of who you are, then that's a great thing if they support you in that way. And that's how my family has been. And that's really fortunate for me.
Yeah. Sounds really good that your family helped you and really they are with you. So you can do this and you can help others as well. So now let's move toward the polar journeys, because you are famous for the journeys. And everybody is excited to listen more about that. And what happened with you when you have a polar bear and all the stuff. But just let do before then that. What is the Adventure Grand Slam? Just give me a brief introduction of that particular thing. And I have also seen your interview at the blog of National Geography that I have read that it was unsupported and unassisted. So what do you mean that unsupported and unassisted meaning that?
Yeah. So when the thing that's become a little bit more of an objective is the Grand Slam kind of title. And it's actually a few different, it's been a progression over since I've been in the outdoors. Mm-hmm. Originally, the Adventures Grand Slam was to climb the seven summits, the highest mountain on each continent, and then ski North and South Pole expeditions, full-length ones from the coast, like Canada to the North Pole, and from the coast of South Antarctica to the South Pole. And then over the years, there is a little bit of a change to this Explorer's Grand Slam, which is what a lot of people call now, doing that same thing, but for the polar ski trips, they're just doing what's called a last degree. So the last degree of latitude to the poles, and that's 60 nautical miles. So it's a much shorter, you know, you're talking like 7-8 days of skiing, as opposed to long 50-day trips from a coastal start to a pole. So what I did personally is the Adventures Grand Slam, the old way, which means the climbs and then those full-length trips, unsupported and unassisted. And so unsupported means without resupplies, like getting drops or caches of food and supplies along the way.
Oh, okay.
Just starting from the beginning and taking everything for your whole journey. That's the supported versus unsupported. And the unassisted term means not using any assistance, such as kites for like kite skiing or dogs or any kind of assistance other than you just pulling your sled. So that's kind of the determining things of those like unsupported and unassisted. So, and so there's a pretty small group of people, I think 11 or 12 around the world that have done it both those ways. And also assisted, there's like many terms, but if you get guided, then it's considered assisted, right? Because you got assistance from a guide while you were skiing. So, so if you look at this, people that have done that Grand Slam without assistance and without support, then there's only like, I think I was the 11th person to do it
in
the world. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's definitely a small club to get in.
There are only 12 people who have done, and you are on the rank of the 11th number, and it's amazing. And what is the amazing thing that I have done skiing, but it was the slope. I have done on mountain, so it's easy. You have the speed, you have all the stuff, and you just move around. But when it's time to move for the at the North Pole, at the South Pole, what are the situation over there? Like I can say. There is no any rock, I believe so.
Right.
And there are just the ice. And that's why I have a question that, especially for your South Pole trip, and you have done your journey, and you have faced a lot of difficulties over there that I have seen. And what happened is, when I have read, my curiosity hype, because I have read about the polar bear encounter and the emotional moment of you and your expedition partner, Eric. And it blew my mind that it happened. It can happen to the world's strongest person. So that's why I'm curious to know that what is the feeling, what is the adventure and the emotion, and also the danger of that particular journey.
Up on the Arctic Ocean, so then going to the North Pole is where you have polar bears, and they're out there, and so you're basically in their world, and in the, technically in the food chain. And so, we had, you know, it's not uncommon for people that do expeditions in the Arctic to have some close encounters with polar bears, and so we certainly had ours with early on in our ski trip. You know, not far from the coast of Canada at Cape Discovery, it was probably, I think it was like 6 days in. And we were pulling along, at the time our sleds, each of our sleds was so heavy still, and the surface too rough. So we would both clip into one sled and pull it forward for a while and go back and get the other one. ski it forward. So it was like this leapfrogging thing going on. And so we just happened to stop with one of the sleds in this day and turn around, and these two bears were walking in our tracks. Wow. Maybe by that time, 15 feet away. 15 and feet. So we were alarmed, obviously, and you throw off your mittens and try to get your flares, which are in your pockets or in your sled right there. You know, they just kept walking at us, and we shot small pen flares that we keep in our pockets, and that slowed them a little bit, but they just kept walking at us. And very luckily, we happened to have the one sled that had our gun in it.
Okay.
And it gave us time with the small flares to be able to get the gun out. And my buddy Eric was the one that was able to reach in, get the gun out. And the first two rounds in that shotgun are like designed as bear scares. So it shoots out and explodes, and it just makes a loud bang to try to get them to turn and run. And so thankfully that did work for us. And by the time they turned, they were very close, like 10 feet. And it was scary for sure. I mean, because we didn't know they were walking behind us. Normally, if you see bears out on the Arctic Ocean, it's more typical to see them far off while they're circling around, because they smell something that they're not used to. And they'll usually do big circles and come in closer and closer and closer. And so you usually see them, you know, far off in the distance, and they're kind of circling around you to try to figure out what you are. And these bears just happened to walk behind us in our track, and we didn't even know it. So we were just lucky we didn't get a swipe from a paw in it, because it would have just like been over right there.
Oh my goodness. So it's like the behavior of the bears were also weird, because as usually they first recognize what you are, is the food or anything else. But the bears that they were following you, that was really uncommon at that situation.
Yeah. Usually they're inquisitive, and they want to figure out what you are, because they're just looking for food, and maybe you're a food source. And so this was a mother and basically a teenage bear, like her cub, but it was like halfway grown up. And so they're just probably walking in and picked up our scent and happened to start following us just to see what we were. And we were just really lucky that we happened to stop and turn around when we did. And also that we had the gun in the sled that we were pulling, because if we would have been taking the other sled just by total chance, you know, maybe I wouldn't be here to talk to you today, because we just happened to have the gun with us at that time.
I believe so. And this kind of uncertain situation can happen while you are doing this kind of dangerous journeys. I understand that. And the important thing I was thinking is like, how you started your journey from United States. What was the first steps you have done, and how you reach over there, and then how you landed over there and just started the journey?
Well, it actually is a lot, kind of like the Everest discussion. There's a lot of time to get it ready. Like, we fly from here to, I think we went to Calgary in Canada, and then from Calgary up to, Resolute, which is a really small town up in the way north. And we stayed in Resolute for almost 2 weeks, getting ready, packing all of our stuff that had been shipped up there. We got delayed a little because of the next flight. We couldn't fly up to the start for a while, but then we take a ski equipped plane all the way up and land in Cape Discovery, which is our starting point. And then from there, you start skiing. So it's a lot of process to get in place to start that trip. And
it's a whole road journey.
It's a long journey. Yeah. It took, you know, we took 53 days to do that from the coast to the North Pole. And so the whole trip with travel and getting ready and everything was over 2 months easy. I'm not sure how long, maybe two and a half.
Yes. Yeah. It was about like 77 days I have read somewhere. And
yeah, it sounds right.
Yeah. So it's also important that the discussion point when I have recorded one of the episode about the environment and the current situation. So after your North Pole expedition in, I think in 2014, if I'm right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in 2014, and then after 1 year in 2015, two other explorers, they tried to complete this journey in order to gather some data for the scientific or the science initiatives. And, but the situation was so bad. And unfortunately, due to the brutal weather and the melting ice, they couldn't survive over there and they died over there. So yeah. What about the condition at poles right now? And what do you think about the future expedition at Polus, Ryan?
Yeah, the guys in 15, they actually, I think it's believed that they probably fell in water. So they've probably fell in a lead or something, I believe is what everyone was thinking. And so that's obviously dangerous because you can freeze to death in the water. And yeah, it's, you know, it's such a hard trip from on many reasons, physically, financially, just the physical part of it's really difficult. A lot of skills involved to be able to do that you only get from doing a lot of trips. And so that's why there's not a lot of people that try it and even less now, because the big hurdle is the closing down of the season because of kind of the changing climate, not as good ice. And that plays a big part in the logistics of how you can do a attempt a full length trip to the North Pole. Back 12, 15 years ago, or a little bit more than that actually, people that could do it would leave about the same time we did in March and ski to the North Pole, and they could time it to where the logistics company that is up there at certain times of the year doing things for the last degree trips, and they have a helicopter. You used to be able to get picked up at the North Pole through that Russian logistics operator.
Okay.
But as the ice gets worse from changing climate, that operation can't be there as long as they used to be. Okay. So they go earlier almost every year, it seems, and their window is shorter and shorter to put that temporary base on the ice near the North Pole. So that option of skiing to the North Pole and getting picked up by the Russians in the helicopter isn't really there anymore. And so what we did is we hired this Canadian flight company with fixed wing planes to come to the pole. And that's a way more expensive option, but it was the only option we had because of the way things are. And so after we did it and were able to get to the North Pole, that company is no longer going to operate those flights anymore. And so effectively that's kind of closed out people skiing to the North Pole from Canada. And it's really hard from the Russian side now because the ice that used to be all the way up against the landmass of Russia now is pulls off really early. And so you get a lot of open water on that side. So it's more difficult to do. It's harder to ski from land. And so there's just a lot of hurdles to get over. And so no one that I know really tries anymore. I mean, there's been a couple attempts to ski, and a friend of mine even tried this past spring from the Russia side, and they just ran into too much open water and hard logistics. So they stopped their attempt. So.
Oh, so the situation is really worse, because if it is the matter of environmental issue, and if keep going on, then I can say we need to close all the expedition at the polars, if I'm right.
Well, no, I mean, you know, it's still possible to try to ski to the North Pole from land, it's just harder to, you got to figure out how you're going to get to the start. You know, you could take a snowmobile from somewhere and go for a month to get there. You know, there's options. It's just that it's really hard and it's far away and it's difficult. And so that's why this Explorers Grand Slam nowadays, more people are still doing it, but they're using this last degree North Pole ski trip, because you still can fly up there in a helicopter early April and ski for a week to the pole and then take the flights back to Norway and you're done. And so that's why you still hear people skiing to the North Pole. It's just they're doing a much shorter version and very short time. And it's like you get dropped off on the ice and you ski for a week and you're there. Great. And then you fly back home. So it's still hard and it's challenging and all that. It's just a shorter version.
Okay. It's unbelievable. The thing that is happening is really unbelievable. Just a single question, that why there was a tear in your eyes under your goggles while you were at the, while you were doing the journey at the polar? What was the situation? What was the emotion?
From our documentary on the North Pole, there was a day that was a very hard for some reason. I mean, all the days were hard, but there was one specific day, at least for me. You know, me and Eric were giving it everything for many, many days. It was probably day 48 or something like that. And it was just a really hard day, very flat light where you can't see anything because of whiteout conditions. We weren't making distance. We were getting really close to the North Pole, but it was very bad ice, like chunks, and we were running into open water. And it was just really much harder than you would think it would be that close to the pole, because in days past, it used to get easier when you got to the pole because it's so far north that it was always frozen. And so you didn't run into different pans of ice crashing into each other. But nowadays it's much more broken up, even way up to the north.
Yeah.
And so I was out in the lead on that particular sentence that I say in this documentary. And it was just really hard. I was trying to lead the way for us because we just flip-flop throughout the day, whoever's leading to follow this compass bearing. And I just kept running into chunks of ice and I couldn't go anywhere. And I was so tired. I hadn't slept in some days. And so I just said, like, I should write a country song called Crying in My Goggles, because I was like, in there crying. I was like, I can't do it. I don't know what's going on. It's so hard. And, you know, I was basically having a pity party for myself. And that was the one time I kind of broke down on the trip. But, you know, we just kept going and like, we can do it. And we supported each other. And that's what the advantage of having a partner is. You can kind of help each other through those times when someone's having a really down day. You can be like, come on, we can do this. Let me go in the front for a while. You just take a rest and get behind me and that kind of thing. And so that's how we got through that.
It's unbelievable for me to have such an unpredicted condition, the situation and the atmosphere that is really, you cannot do anything. Just you have to survive. You have to reach to your goal. That's all you can do. Other than that, you have to have a one option, to die. That's all.
Yeah. Kind of true. Yeah.
Yeah. And that makes sense for you and your buddy, Eric, that you have did all this stuff and just completed it unassisted and unsupported. It's phenomenal thing, man. It's really phenomenal thing. And, I believe I salute your motivation to help each other at that situation, to get around this situation and to succeed what you are going to do at this moment. Yeah. And it blew my mind.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm glad you enjoyed the story. It was definitely a fun experience. It's hard but fun, and it's more fun when it's over on that trip. But
I believe so. When you get it done, that's the fun part. Yeah. I can understand. So now it's the very interesting session of the podcast, and it's like a rapid question answer session where I will give you some of the quick question and you just need to me a answers. So the first question is, among all the trips, what is your amazing and most favorite journey? Like, you learn a lot, you love that journey during the way, and what kind of, what do you feel that about?
Yeah, I have quite a lot of them, and I have some in the mountains, but I think a really amazing journey was in 2009-10, me and Cecilia Skog from Norway, we skied a crossing of Antarctica. Wow. And that, to me, that was like, I had skied across Greenland, but I hadn't done lots of polar stuff yet. And so that was a big challenge. Obviously, it's like a huge distance. It took 70 days to ski across. And so that was my first big experience skiing into the South Pole and then going to the other side, to the ice shelf, just off the mainland. And we went to the Ross ice shelf. But that was amazing. I mean, very difficult, really hard mentally, but we skied, I think it was 1,800 kilometers in the end. So it was quite a crazy trip.
I believe so. I understand that. The second question I want to ask, because generally people do something like a hobby in their spare times, but you choose your hobby as your main career. So what do you do in your spare time?
It's shifted a lot over the years. I used to climb a lot. I don't rock climb as much anymore. I'm mostly mountain bike for fun now. So me and a lot of my close friends, they're big into mountain biking. So we do that all the time. That's kind of like our exercise.
Oh, that's interesting. Amazing. So you have said it first in the starting of the interview that you have read lots of books and all. So which one is your favorite book and author and why?
Oh yeah, I was thinking of this book thought, and I think one of the books that really spurred me, it's not a recent book, but a guy, David Brashears, he's an American mountaineer from back when I was young, like getting into high altitude mountaineering. Uh-huh. He wrote a book that was called High Exposure, and that was like a book I read all the time when I was like 20, and really was amazed at this whole Everest and the Himalayas and stuff like that. He's still around somewhat, but really accomplished guy. And he directed the film Everest for the IMAX movie back in the day, the first one that came out. So his books were really cool for me.
Oh, wonderful. And I have that same book right now with me. Nice. Okay. The fourth question is, like, do you have any message for the people who want or who love to explore the Mount Everest or the poles in the future?
I think it's, if you have the desire and the dream, I think it's an incredible journey to do, but take the time and look at it as a big project, you know, like it's an excuse to go to places you may would not have gone to in normal life. Like, and so use it as an excuse to go to really amazing spots around the world and enjoy each one on the way. And don't just look at it as like a step to the next one and try to hurry through. I would say really think through and learn the skills you want and need for these different mountains and enjoy each one for its own experience, and don't just look at the big overall project as the goal. Like,
I understand.
Choose each one and enjoy it.
Yeah, that's the really nice. Enjoy that journey. What you are doing, enjoy that thing. That's the main reason why we are doing all this stuff. Okay, and the last question that I want to ask is, I'm curious about this. The definition of life, or the philosophy for life, in the word of D. Ryan Waters.
That's a good one. Ironically, I'm writing a book right now. And so I've thought a lot about these things, and I'm going back to the things that drove me personally in little short sentences that I've kind of realized that I was doing. And I always come back to this sentence: you have to make things happen for yourself. And the reason I say that is I know a lot of people that are like, oh, I'd love to go do that. Mm-hmm. But they just don't do it for whatever reason, like could be family, they can't afford, or they can't, don't have the right job or this. And so I can say I made things happen for myself because I did take that step when I was young enough and unattached with, you know, any family or commitments. And I just took a leap of faith mm-hmm. to give up like a more solid mm-hmm. kind of career that I could rely on. And I felt the pull so much that I went for my passion and followed it. And it was the best decision I ever made.
Thank you so much. This is wonderful. I believe so that everybody have to follow what actually they want to do in your life. And that's the most important thing I have learned from every successful entrepreneur, every successful person in their particular field. And this conversation with you is really phenomenal. And I have learned a lot of things like from starting to end. And the thing to become a down to earth person while you achieved the Everest. And I learned that thing from you. So it's really important for all of us to learn a lot of stuff from Ryan's talk right now. And when you have difficulties like an Everest, and always remember the skills and the mindset that what Ryan said with us, and he didn't say just the life lessons, but some of the most important topics related to the human spirit, the potential, the determination, and the confidence to survive in life, whatever the condition may be, like the Mount Everest, maybe like the dead zone, but you need to make sure that you want to go ahead what is happening in your life. And we are always, we always proud and thankful to Ryan to share such an inspiring and unbelievable talk with us. And Ryan really proved that once we believe in ourselves, we can risk our curiosity, the wonder, the spontaneous delight, and all the experiences that what we wanna do in our life, and that can reveal the true human spirit. And I think this is one of the best episode of Expertdale podcast. And thank you so much, Ryan, for joining us today. I'm really honored to have you over here. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I appreciate it. And best of luck on all of the rest of the podcasts and with your studies and everything else.
Thank you so much, Ryan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. So don't forget to subscribe and follow us on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Anchor. And you can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Podchaser, Pocket Cast, Breaker, and also on YouTube. And if you like to read something about this episode, you can easily find the keynotes of the episode on our blog. You can get more information in the description. So please go and check it. So stay tuned with us to learn world's powerful techniques, strategies, skills, information to get the virtues of life.